Hello and welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about the book I just wrote. No, all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 347 for Wednesday, the 12th of December, 2012, which of course is 12-12-12. And I'm glad to say it's not 12 o'clock for me, it's 6:38 in the morning. With me in California is Jim Race and Jules Cisek. How you doing, guys?
Hey, hey.
Howdy.
Martin, I was that my idea, Jules, to let him read that out?
Yes.
this is, we're getting towards the end of the year. So 2012 draws to a close, but got a heck of a show. We have got interviews with Simon Pavey, who's about to go off and compete in his ninth Dakar.
Is it only the ninth? I thought it was the 10th already. No. Oh.
No, he's done eight. He's finished six. This will be his ninth.
Excellent.
And next year, of course, or 2014, will be his 10th, when hopefully Llewellyn will be accompanying him, Llewellyn being his son. But we'll hear all about that in the interview. We've got James Whittam with a season review and a look forward to next year and all the shenanigans that have gone on with people changing seats. And it's as entertaining as ever. And we are going to have another interview, we believe, Jim.
Yes, with Josh Hayes answering listener questions, which I'm looking forward to. And there's a great batch of questions that are coming up. 99% sure. I just was texting back and forth with him before we did the show to verify that we're going to be able to do that. So we're going to slip that in through our magical time machine. And then finally, we've got Temples of Speed number two.
Well, that's actually number one. Episode one.
Oh, number one.
That's true. That was intro.
It was a preamble.
Yep.
We're going to have a prequel and all that stuff after a while.
Yes.
but looking forward to it. Temples of Speed number one, mm-hmm, from Steve Brooks, which I know that you guys out there enjoyed. We seriously are. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, Jules, so I'm looking forward to
the
it.
The new one is great.
Cool. Well, of course it is. And he's just got, like I said last time, this mystical aura quality about the way that he talks about this stuff, which, you know, it kind of sinks in. It's like we had one or two listeners say they listened to it like three times in a row just to kind of get into it. I think that's cool.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. We should also mention that donation in the last week was some guy called Nada.
It's been
Spanish American.
Yeah, it's been a very quiet month. Those of you out there that would like to help the show out, I know that we're going into our
hibernation.
Late December hibernation, but certainly it would be awesome. You can get to us through the Facebook fan page or through motopodcast.com. But yeah, I think that's the longest we've ever gone without a donation, or at least in many years. So kind of creeped me out a little bit, but I'm sure it'll come back. We had a bit of a errata via Josh Tutel or Joshua Tutel on Facebook. It was a good reminder, because I got kind of wrapped up in something that Douglas Edmiston said to us. This is regarding, basically, you know, just fabbing up quick change setups for wet dry, in a potential single bike setup. And he said there's no mention of suspension electronic setups between wet and dry, which is something that's currently, obviously, being done there with two different bikes. And it does make a huge difference. They don't just swap tires. And very true. I was just too busy beating down Mr. Edmiston to get into that. But that being said, I thought about it a bit when I read that. And essentially what they'd have to do would be to...
Press the button?
There is press a button, but you can't, there's no such thing as suspension electronics right now. It's disallowed. Yeah. But you can, of course, you know, change mapping on the fly. As we know, what was it? Was it Motegi a couple of years ago that Colin went out on a dry race with a wet setup?
Yes.
Wasn't real happy about that. Yeah. But they would have to have a middle ground were that ever to happen. But you know, that's not set in stone yet. So we'll see what happens. But, I don't know. I was just so excited about it. And, you know, we're going to talk about that a bit, but another note Doug wrote to me on Twitter and basically was trying to mock me again. And I'm like, I'm not taking that bait. Speaking of which, listener feedback, who wants to read this one? I'm over it.
I'll do this, but first we need to pour some beverages. So,
oh my gosh. Well, yeah, hold on please. There. Oh, Jules, you are a sophisticated bastard.
That's right. I'm going for the naked grape.
Nice. I'm going for old school.
Right on. And poor Martin over there. How's that kettle doing?
Yeah, the kettle's boiled. I've got coffee.
All right.
Martin, in case you guys are wondering why his sound is just a little bit different, is currently at the Wales Air Ambulance base in freezing weather with no shower. So if you're catching something through the speakers, that would be Martin sort of...
That's my man smell.
We're definitely getting it here on Skype.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So we got listener feedback from some guy named Douglas Edmiston. He says, I sort of agree with Casey Stoner, feels that paved runoff makes riders less scared and the racing doesn't have the same risk and whatever. But Phillip Island is one of those tracks where I feel it really needs paved runoff. Not much of it, but just enough to give riders an added distance to brake before hitting the gravel trap. Better to continue slowing down to below 100 miles per hour rather than being off in the gravel at 120. I've run off at 100 before, and that's scary enough, especially with the damaged gopher holes at Jennings. So I can't imagine bombing down into T1 at the speeds they do and having to run on, which we've seen, obviously, many times at Phillip Island. And actually, the crash I remember that was one of the scariest ones was...
Caparossi. That one was ugly.
Now I was thinking of the one where Rossi went off. I think it was still when he was riding the yellow bike. So that must have been like 2005
yep.
or 6. And it was that the long fast corner, I believe. You know, the end.
Yeah, yeah.
He was going super, super, super fast and just missed the straight.
Yeah, well, there's been a couple of guys that have been hurt there. I think that was the same one, was it not, that took Lorenzo's pinky tip?
Was it also at the end there?
I believe it was. But something interesting and very timely with the email from Doug is they're in the process or just finished repaving Phillip Island. And I read this today, and they basically took 40 millimeters or 40 centimeters off. That's a lot. That'd be way too much of the thing, and completely repaved the circuit. Now, they did it, I read, with the assistance of one Casey
That's right.
Stoner.
Yeah, I saw that.
And the thing that
He's
I thought
a consultant.
Was yeah, as a consultant. But the thing that I was really interesting about it was that they were asking him which bumps they should take out and which bumps they should leave in.
Oh, wow.
And the conspiracy theorist in me said, okay, well, he knows the guys that can handle certain bumps
exactly.
and the guys that can't. And so, and in addition to that, they
we'll call
did
this
also,
one Rossi. We'll call this
yeah, one. Yeah. He's got Stoner Corner. Now he's got Rossi bump and he's got Danny Wiggle. But they also did, my understanding, add some additional runoff in a couple of areas. So
oh, wow.
there
so
you
it's
go.
Done. And you know, you know, Ed Hauser is going there with Jimmy Mack
yep.
for the Island Classic. Maybe they'll be able to tell us what a difference that made.
Yep, and we'll have Phil Hall back there to cover that for us.
Oh, so. Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
All right, moving on with Douglas.
Yep.
The second part of the email, he says, "And the Macau GP coverage. What the hell was up with that crap? 10-lap race." And 3 laps of nothing but Simon Andrews, Gary and Johnson, John Mabrigwe piss water beer, and Martin Jessup with a rare glimpse of rudder, and then the rest being nothing but Jessup. I've seen better coverage of motorcycle racing in the movie Torque, especially... By the way, that is probably the worst movie I've ever seen that had motorcycles in it. Anyway, especially that totally fucking awesome train scene where the chicks were like doing some judo wheel fighting shit while wheeling. My favorite scene that was when the sports bikes went off-roading. But
I'm proud to say that I've only ever seen a complete total of about 4 minutes of Torque where I said no.
I've never heard.
Apparently, this is before Douglas got to watch the onboard, because, yeah. I mean, granted, there's not that much that you see from the onboard in terms of like passing and stuff, because we only see him get passed once and then passing somebody once. So
I think something that I can point out about this is that the vast majority of the film work that's, or of the camera work that's done at that race over the weekend
car
is
guys.
On cars.
Car guys, exactly. Exactly.
And so you come around to a motorcycle race, and they're, you know, no pun intended, they're trying to shift gears and figure that out. And, you know, when you've got motorcycle races, you've got dedicated motorcycle racing cameramen.
Yep.
And so it's kind of a completely different thing. I mean, I haven't seen, I'm not sure if I've ever seen really high quality footage of a Macau GP. One of the things that I did catch, though, was that Brandon Cretu got some great airtime because they mistook him for Michael Rutter coming around the last couple of corners. Yeah. And so he got all sorts of airtime. They gave him the checkered flag, followed by Michael Rutter, who came across behind.
That's awesome.
So and he also missed out on a lap because of that, because he slowed down thinking, what the hell.
So did anyway, he also go to the podium?
No, he did not go to the podium. We were all kind of cracking up about that online when it was happening. Anyway, so yeah, that was cool. So we hope we covered all that for you. That was a funny email, Doug. Jesse Walters wrote in, and I have to apologize to both of you guys, cause I ended up in an extended conversation with him about this, but he was talking about something. He says, hello again from Northern Minnesota. He says, with the explosion of 250 to 300 CC sport bike models by the major manufacturers coming to the US and elsewhere, that's from me, how will this impact club and national level motorbike racing? Will we see a 250 CC four-stroke AMA class? Well, some of the Ninja 250 Cup series were providing good racing. It would be neat to see an all-out factory battle in the 250 CC range. In the 50s, I believe there was a four-stroke 250 CC supercharged class, one which one could only dream of such ludicrous bikes now. But the real glory time of that, Jesse, was back in the 60s when we had the RC166, a six-cylinder 250 CC four-stroke.
Oh, God, those things were incredible.
Yeah, 20,000 RPM and had like 87 gears and everything was handcrafted. But
wasn't there a YouTube video where Agostini fires that sucker up for a lap at Imola or someplace like that, or Monza?
Yeah. Well, they had one when I was there at the TT.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and they had that. They had that, and they had the I think the four cylinder 50. I think I had an audio recording that we used for the show back at the TT times.
I remember the 450. I remember the 166 though. Do not remember.
This was a four-cylinder 50cc bike. Yeah. That thing was crazy. Yeah. 12-speed. Someday we might have four-stroke. Well, okay, here's an interesting thing. Will the manufacturers do it? Yes, when the economy picks up. We did have a 250 Ninja Cup in I think it was either the CEV or the Italian-Spanish Championship that was pretty big. They used to race the 250s. As the junior cup.
But those two strokes.
No, those were four strokes.
Oh really?
Yeah. They I believe had the Ninja 250 as the junior cup that was running along with the World Superbike Superstock guys for a while. Now they went on to KTM 590s and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm not even sure what they're running this year. That's being run by Simon Crafar, or it was. We'll have to see. We're going to see. And on top of that, just today, I heard that we're going to have, I'm very stoked about this, the Red Bull Rookies Cup at the Austin GP we'll be going to, Jules, which is the new, this is the first year, that's it for the two strokes. This will be the 250 four strokes coming to the States. So that's the KTM 250, pretty close to, pretty damn close to a Moto 3 bike. And that'll be cool to see.
I'm so psyched to see the Riders Cup here in the States again.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Yep. It's been a long time. Somebody carry on.
You want to do the Mike Moynihan one?
Yeah, Mike got in touch with us, and this was to do with the discussion about if Casey hadn't retired, I was surmising that Danny would have been out of a seat. And Mike says he disagrees that if Stone had stayed, HRC would have found a fifth bike for Pedrosa. Honda would have dug their heels in at four, and Bautista would have been gone. Remember, the Gresini seat was blowing in the wind forever, even after he got a podium in Italy. It wasn't until he got on the steps the second time in Japan, and not until mid-October when he was confirmed for 2013. If Casey stayed, Bautista would have long lost his ride prior to Japan, with Honda sticking to their guns of four bikes, and the rides would have gone to Stoner, Marquez, Pradl and Pedrosa. Though I could have seen the Gresini team taking Olin's instead of sticking with Showa. And Mike finishes with, hey, tell McCormack to email me. The skiing is awesome at the lake.
I did forward Mike's email directly with email address and everything to Brett McCormack. So, Mike, Brett's got your email address.
Nice. Yeah, so if he doesn't reply, don't blame us. but I've got to come back to the thing we discussed when we talked about this in the past. Of, I see Mike's point. They might well have had to stick at four bikes, but who would have gotten Gresini? Because you ain't going to send Marquez there because of his association with Repsol. And Gresini aren't this, but they have Castrol sponsorship. Pedrosa, equally. Bradl was tied in at LCR for another year. And Stoner, if he'd stayed, would have been number one rider. So he'd have been. So I still think, no, that was a major problem. I don't know which of them would have gone to Gresini, but it would have had to have been either Pedrosa or Marquez, which would have meant Repsol dropping their personal sponsorship of one of them. So again, I'd say probably would have been Pedrosa.
But on top of that, Martin, also the factory class bike moved from Gresini to LCR this year, or for 2013. Yeah. So that throws a whole another spanner in the works.
Yeah. So anyway, Casey did decide to retire, so we'll never know.
We will never know. Do we want to toss an interview in here, guys? Maybe, I don't know.
Okay, so. Is there any World Superbike news that we need to cover before we talk to James Whittam? Maybe we should just do James right now. Yeah.
We go through an awful lot of the silly season ending off, which has been very late, particularly in World Superbikes.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's quite pertinent to put James in here because Doug is going to hear a little bit. Remember when Doug was saying, when we were talking about the quick tyre change equipment?
Right.
Similar to Endurance World Championship. And I was saying, oh, you can knock it up in 5 minutes on a lathe. James kind of puts that one to him and says, no, if you want the fast kit, it is incredibly expensive. So there's a little bit about that. And basically, yeah, season review, season preview with the ever entertaining Mr. James Whittam.
Well, if somebody's going to bang on Doug, I say we run it immediately.
Yeah. Let's do that.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm here, busy, off to Verbier tomorrow. Foggy is with James Blunt and Lawrence Diallo setting up some kind of bar, ski, lodge, bar type thing.
I was going to say, that's quite divert. James Blunt, the singer?
Yeah, James Blunt, the singer. Lawrence Diallo, the baldy, big rugby dude.
Yeah.
And Fogarty, the ugly ex-bike racer, they're setting up this sort of wine bar. I don't know just what it is, but this big opening ceremony this weekend, so we're all going out there to get drunk and you know, make a mess of it.
You can do a bit of skiing, or have they not got the
snowboarding?
Snowboarding?
Yeah, I can't ski.
No, I can't snowboard. I've never been any good with my feet together.
Well...
Water skiing, snowboard, skateboards. I used to fall off them as a kid, but...
The thing is, it's my knees that are knackered. I used to ski years ago, but my right knee is that bigger now. Just, you know, you just angle the strength to control one ski when on a board. They sort of support each other, your legs, you know?
Right. The season. Wow. Crazy. One thing. Max wins by half a point and then retires. Was that expected? Because I've got to be honest... The interviews I heard with him right after the win, you know, in the race weekend at Manicure, yeah. I thought, no, he's going to come back. But what was your guys' feeling?
I thought the opposite. I thought that he'd won the championship. There was a big sort of there was a sort of palpable sense of relief on his part from where we saw it. We were down there, me and Jack, and you could tell that he'd been pushed close, and he, you know, hadn't really sort of enjoyed it, and it was a bit of a close run thing. He knew that, and afterwards in the press conference that me and Jack went to watch, he said, you know, I won it by half a point. It pushed me close, and I'm sure that Tom Sykes' year will sort of come. And that he just had that kind of, I've had enough of this, to me.
Yeah.
He said it at the time, me and Jack at the time. When I heard him, his post-race, I thought, he's going to retire. It was no surprise to us, because it's just how it felt. And what can you say? A perfect career. Don't come much better. He's walking away a rich man and in one piece. You know,
yeah.
Several times a world champ. Well, you know, that you don't get much better than that in the sport, do you?
No. I certainly think he's put to bed that feeling when he left MotoGP of he was almost like he was hounded out, because his talent was undoubted, but he was just obviously so difficult to work with at times.
Yeah,
but it was as magnanimous as I've ever heard him about Tom. And which brings us nicely on to Tom Sykes, because I think it was beginning of the last season or season before, where it almost looked like after a very promising first season, he was going to get pushed out. And the team manager, I'm trying to think, was it Paul Bird who pushed to keep Tom riding the Kawasaki?
Yeah, what happened was he had a year at Yamaha and kind of underperformed a little bit. He had his moments, but I think they were expecting a little bit more. He then went to Paul Bird and Kawasaki, Paul Bird was running then the official Kawasaki squad. And then At the end of that year, Kawasaki wanted to get rid of him, and it was Birdie who kind of paid his wages and kept him on, and look at it now, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, it's awful what happened to Juan Lascurs, but it certainly felt that Tom wasn't the Kawasaki's preferred, you know, rider, but hey, look at it now.
No, good. No, he's there, golden child now.
And when it was a bit of a crazy season, weather as much as anything, I saw you guys at Alton when we had the Monza debacle going on.
Yeah.
And it just happened time and time again. And we're looking forward to next year. We've got the rule changes coming in. It's going to be single bike rule.
Yeah.
And one thing I'm really fascinated by, we spoke to Hervé Poncharal back at Silverstone, and they were talking about the various rule changes proposed, and he was adamant that a single bike rule doesn't actually save you very much money at all, because he said you still have two bikes, just one of them's in bits. It will be interesting for you guys to sort of see if the teams feel, yes, it is a saving, or are the penalties that they'll pay.
We've gone through this with British Superbike. It's not much of a saving. You do actually need to have at least one of every component that makes up a bike. You can have sub-assemblies already built up, so you can have a complete front end with brakes and everything else on it. You can have a rear subframe with everything fastened on it, wiring low, etc. Whether it saves money for teams, questionable. Possibly for some, for most who are going to get well equipped with the spares they can have, possibly not. It does make it more difficult in the fact that if you have a bit of a, you know, if you go upside down anywhere near time qualifying or race, there's going to be issues putting the bike back together. There's been questions of safety in that, you know, you're under pressure to rush your man back out, maybe in time practice, you know, to put a time in that he's going to need to get on the grid, maybe with a bike that has, you know, undetermined kind of damage that you haven't seen, that's been missed, an oil leak, cracking a brake lever, whatever. It's not universally popular, the single bike rule, and you know, by no means certainly it saves money. It does for some, it doesn't for others, I don't think.
And I guess we're going to see the Endurance World Championship wheel changes, if we do have, which after this year seems quite likely, a wet to dry or a dry to wet race. That's going to be tricky, though, isn't it? Because you've got these guys, they're fighting for fractions of seconds, lap after lap. And you look at the differences you can have in a pit stop.
Yeah, that's the thing. Now, I haven't just read the letter of the the rule changes, because certainly, you know, it's quite expensive to properly get a bike. If it's on a third course, that's fine. But if they're then going for, you know, finish start to finish races where, you know, tyre changes are definitely going to come into it, well, in that case, in my opinion, they've got to have some kind of limit on how far the teams can go to get quick release and quick fit wheels and all the rest of it. Because in Superbike, sorry, in Endurance World Championship, they've got some setups there where, I mean, it's expensive because there's not many about and it's a lot of engineering involved. But they have quick release wheels. You know, if each team had to get equipped with proper forks with the quick release bottom ends where the calipers spin out as you pull the wheel out and then go back in and everything all fits. You can do these wheel changes in about 20 seconds. You can do both wheels in World Endurance Championship pit stops.
Yeah.
So that's going to cost you probably for, you know, five sets of wheels with the quick release stuff on and the forks, it's probably going to cost you, I don't know, 40 or 50 grand, I would have said. It's quite expensive. So I don't know whether that's a retrograde step or not in actual, you know, costs. But if they say, look, you can only run your standard stuff you had last year, now they're going to police it, I don't know. But I've yet to see what the exact rules are, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I read something that said you'd be allowed three mechanics, but the rider can assist per bike.
It's the equipment. It's not the, it's not the staff that
right.
It's the equipment. Because I tell you what, I've raced World Endurance for factory teams, both Suzuki and Yamaha, and they can do a rider change, a full tank of fuel, both wheels, and in some pit stops every about 8 hours, a set of front pads, and they can do that in 25 seconds.
That's mad. But
they can only do it in 25 seconds because they've got the stand goes in to a slot that slots between the engine and the frame and lifts it up on air. You know, that costs a lot of money getting set then. The wheels and forks are all built for it properly. The sprocket stays where it is instead of coming out of the wheel, etc. It's not cheap. So I don't know. Well, I don't know what they're going to do. I'll have to sort of catch up with it when it's announced properly what the rules are going to be.
Yeah. I mean, apart from the rule changes, rider changes, it's been quite a busy, not silly season, but it's just happened so late with World Superbikes. There's stuff that, you know, we're getting to the end of the season, we still weren't sure. Eugene staying at Aprilia factory, joined by Sylvain Guintoli, which I think is, you know, as you and Jack like to call him, our honorary Englishman. Adopted Englishman, you know, good news. There were strong rumours Davide Giuliano might get that gig, but Sylvain's got it, which will be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that will be interesting. Don't know about Sylvain. I love Sylvain. We all do. Is he capable of winning in the dry? Don't know. Maybe on that bike it might suit him. He's done a lot of GP stuff. Will Eugene be quick? Yeah, he will. Other people will be quick, definitely going off testing times and what happened at the end of last year at Tom Sykes. Stays in the same team and there's continuity and the bike's only getting better. His teammates with Baz. Fixie Clint Suzuki is Camier and Jules Cozell. Now, I think that's he's a good find, is Jules. No mug. It remains to be seen whether he'll convert to a superbike rider. I think he will. He's a clever lad, and I hate him. What else we got? Jonathan Ray and
Leon, of course.
Brilliant team for us. They'll both be quick, I think. I think Leon will go well on the on days. He's ridden it before. He knows exactly how it works, and there's big effort going in from HRC to get the electronics and engine speed and power up, which has been lacking, I think, up to now. What else we've
and
got?
Of course, Alstari Ducati with Checa and Badovini.
That's it. And I think, I'll tell you what, there's one thing about Alstar, the batters know how to put a team together, and that'll be a good team. There is no question of that. Panigale won't be any good. I think it will. Yep. Depends how much effort Ducati are putting in the cells, and there's rumour to be quite a lot by way of backup. So that'll be a good team. I've no question. There's no question that will be a good team. Check it. Not out of the way for another championship, I don't think.
No. He just seems to be able to go on and on, doesn't he?
Yeah, and after, I honestly think the bike will be really good. Who else is there?
You've got Michel Fabrizio on the Red Devils Roma Aprilia. Max Neukirchner on the MR Ducati.
Yeah, Max won't do anything. I'm sorry. I like the bloke. He's done.
Yeah.
In my opinion. He's knocked himself about too much. But I'd love to see him prove me wrong. Then you've got the Italian BMW squad with Melandri and Davis. And I think, yeah, good. I think Davis will be good, you know, this next year.
Yeah.
I really do.
I mean, what was your feeling? It struck me that Marco Melandri threw the championship away. And was it just unlucky, or did he start to crack under pressure towards the end there?
I think cracking under pressure. I think he cracked, fell off a bit. I think Biaggi, to some extent, cracked up a little bit. He fell off a bit. The only bloke who didn't crack under the pressure was Tom Sykes, and that nearly won him as champion. He closed up about 30-odd points in two meetings.
Yeah, because I remember with about two or three meets to go, it was like, well, mathematically, Tom's still in it, but, you know, let's face it.
I've been really impressed with Tom the way he hasn't cracked. And all his DNFs have pretty much been either breakdowns or at Monza, he won one and only got half points, and then he would have definitely been up the top in the top three in the other, and they didn't win it. Portimao, he went on to Portimao, dropped a valve, he had a water leak at Assen, he got knocked off by Badavini somewhere, you know, had a lot of
that was the one.
Tom.
There was the Assen one, wasn't it? It was where we thought that the engine was smoking, and he said afterwards, no, it was just water.
Yeah, it was water coming out to Assen, yeah.
He filled his boot up or something with water.
I don't know what, but I mean, what I'm saying is, you know, through no fault of his own, he lost, you know, 70 or 80 points, at least, you know, both Melandri and Biaggi threw it away themselves, really, you know, so Tom's had a good year.
Jim had Brett McCormack on the show the other day, who was one of the only, well, he was the sole survivor of the whole season with Effinbert Liberty. Any news? I mean, there's rumours they might do something with BMW or Aprilia. I mean, that team just seemed to run a crazy season.
Yeah, I mean, you knew it was going wrong quite early on when they started sort of laying mechanics up and rumours were going about the paddock, they'd run out of money, and sure enough, I think that was the problem. I don't think it was anything other than the financial. Bit sad for Smirts, I guess, and everybody else involved. But, you know, I think they were just kind of a victim of the present economic climate, I guess. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it was rumoured to be happening. It just took a long time to happen, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And at first I was thinking, why on earth? They first want to get rid of Sylvain Guinzoli just after he's won a race for them. And then I guess it was the wages. It was the fact that, you know, you get rid of him because he's probably the highest profile, so he's on the biggest wages, and then so on and so forth down the line. And Brett survived the season in both ways, having had that horrible crash with Checa earlier on when he broke his neck. But he seems to be recovered. I mean, do you guys expect to see them back?
No, I don't. I haven't heard anything, and I think I would have done by now. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Unless if, you know, one of us have been, let's just won the lottery. I don't know, but I mean, yeah, I mean, it's just weird how it happened. You knew they were running out of money when they were saying that they'd finished Guintoli because of poor results. Well, you know, they basically finished the people who were paying and kept the ones that were paying for the ride. So.
I think it was you and Jack saying that whoever sends out their press releases seems to do it at 2 a.m. just after they've left the bar. And then when they wake up the next morning, go, oh my God, I didn't actually send that out, did I? And then they send a more sensible one out.
Yeah,
but it was bizarre.
It was Jack, and it was really bizarre the way that all that unfolded, really, to be honest. But I really don't know what's going on with them. I haven't heard anything they're going to be back, you know, at all.
Interesting news in World Supersports. Parking Go going to run MV Agusta F3s. Oh my God, they're the just the most, it's bike porn, isn't it? They are absolutely stunning, in my humble opinion.
They are very, very nice, but don't know whether they can make a, they've got a lot of developing to do. I think it'll have some top end, the bike does. I honestly think, I'm not so much sure in world supersport because I don't know who's going to run them, how much effort's going in, but I certainly think in Britain, I think that new Triumph 675 is going to be the thing to be.
Well, in BSB, Envy are going in with the F4, aren't they? I don't know if they're going in on the supersport level, but certainly going in with BSB.
Superbike.
Superbike sponsored by Robinsons up at the Rochdale dealers.
Yeah, again, I don't think it's a massively funded team, and it's going to be hard work for them. In a lot of ways, British superbikes is going to be easy for them because the rules are such that it's not as difficult as it is at World Championship to build a competitive bike. Engine specs more super stock than it is old superbike rules, and it should be they should be able to build a bike easier than they could do for World Superbike. But all that means is everybody else can do the same and be going into a more competitive championship in that respect. So, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I wish them all the best. It is a nice-looking thing. It's always had a lot of top end. It just always has had. I've been on a couple of launches on the F4 and, the real top ender. But is that what you need for Kendall Park? Probably not.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And Sam Lowe's 3-year contract with Yaknich Motorsport and Yamaha come back into World Superbike paddock, albeit at World Supersport level at this stage.
Yeah, and that's a good move. I mean, I've spoke to Sam down at the bike show last week, and he's quite happy with it. It's essentially it's an Italian team with Russian money, is what it is.
Yeah.
That can't be a bad thing. Yamaha's in there. He's got, I think what really did it for him was the fact that he's got a guaranteed superbike ride in 2014, but he really feels like he has unfinished business in super sport for next year. And he wants one real good crack at winning it. And, then he'd be happy to move on. I mean, he's moving on anyway if he don't win it next year, as long as he's quick enough. So, but I think that he'd kick himself if he didn't win it.
Now, they are going to give them new R6s, aren't they? Because Yamaha seems to have this habit of, like Cal one on it. They put them in mothballs, and then a couple of years later, pulled them out and then gave them to, I'm trying to think, who won the next one?
Yeah,
it was Charles, wasn't it?
Charles. The thing is, I don't know whether they are or not. I mean, they certainly have the potential to be a winning bike, I think. A lot of it depends how much effort Yamaha themselves put in. Itself. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the bike as a standard bike. So there's no reason you can't make it into a competitive bike. That should have top end as well. He's ridden it already. He says that it's quick, handles completely different. It's a little bit lazier front end wise than a Honda. But then again, he's been on the Honda. He knows exactly what it can do, and he's yet to sort of explore the limits of the Yamaha. I think he'll be all right on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, both the Lowe twins seem to they seem to have what it takes, and
yeah,
you could see him almost through the season developing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're dead right. I think they have got what it takes. I think that Alex has started to show a little bit of his true potential now, and I was chatting with him down there at the NEC, and it's quite possible that the career paths sort of diverged a couple of years ago, and do you know what, now they're kind of converging again. You can see a scenario in a couple of years where they both involve Superbike, which will be good.
I mean, obviously they are going to be competitive with each other. I guess they grew up being competitive with each other. Is there a feeling which one generally has the edge on the other, or are they pretty much wouldn't they ever admit to that?
They'd never admit to it, really. It's because I've asked them exactly that question. But if you speak to people who've known them and seen their careers develop, it always was the case that early on in the careers, it was Alex who had the drop and generally got the results. But that's not to say that one hadn't got quicker. You don't always have to stop like that. Just because one were better on, metric kits doesn't mean that'll follow all the way through.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I remember someone asking the Espargaro brothers who's quicker, and they both said the other one. Paul said Alice was quicker, and Alice said Paul was quicker. And then they both started laughing. It's like, yeah, we're not going to get a serious answer out of these two.
No.
The other big thing, I mean, the big change, I suppose, in the paddock is the fact that they're now, Dorna have now the umbrella organisation over both MotoGP and World Superbike. Well, what was the mood when that became clear? Is there a sense of impending doom, or is it quite hopeful?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends which way you look at it. I know that down at Magna Co, when it was announced, it was a little bit doom and gloom. Not doom and gloom, just unknown. You know, what's going to happen? How can this work? You know, they don't care as much about Superbike as what they clearly do for MotoGP. But when you start looking at it, what possible benefit to them would it be to, you know, to merge the championships? It just, there's room for both. It'll work for both. And they'd be doing themselves out of revenue, in my opinion. Because you couldn't run a 28 of 32 round MotoGP championship. Why would you?
No, exactly.
So I think when you think about it, you don't have to be as concerned. I think what will happen, in my opinion, and it's already started happening a little bit, is they'll try and distinguish between the classes a little bit. You know, it's dumbed down, if you like, Superbike, and make them more road-based. You know, we've already seen, you know, they put in light stickers on to make it look like a standard front end and all the rest of it. You know, I think we're going to see Superbikes, and I don't think that's any bad thing. You know, if Superbike technology is backed off somewhat and it's more affordable, we've seen in British Championship that it works. So that I don't think could be a bad thing at all. You know, if anything that puts more bikes on grids is a good thing, really.
I mean, this is one of the things where Moto2 was introduced, and the naysayers were saying, look at their testing times, they're slower than World Supersport. And people were saying, yeah, but they're not racing against World Supersport. And they quickly caught them up anyway. But, you know, it's relative speed to the other bikes on the track on the same day, rather than, looking at...
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of knackers spoke about all this anyway. You know, the big thing down at NEC after the Jerez test was the fact that... it was quicker than there was Eugene Laverty quicker than Nicky Hayden. Well, so what? It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, it is a bit funny when you know it made me laugh a little bit when people have got, you know, really expensive Moto2 bikes with special chassis and, you know, prototype chassis and less weight and all the rest of it, and on better tyres, you know, couldn't go as quick as a slipping stock. Stock season at 600, but they found the feet a little bit, and they are going a bit quicker. And you know, so I mean, I think there's room for both. I do, and I think, you know, if World Superbike organisers said, look, it's super stock-ish engines, or a bit of tuning to create a bit of parity between manufacturers, and no electronics, I don't think that's a bad thing. I really don't.
No, I mean, there was one theory that. When it was announced that Honda are going to give a lot more support to Tenkata next year, with a view to a brand new Fireblade for 2014, you know, a complete sort of rebuild, and they kept making this Nakamoto, as it kept making these threats to Dorna, like, yeah, you're bringing a spec ECU, we're not interested, we're just going to go somewhere else. And then by Dorna taking over World Superbike, it was like, really? Where are you going to go now?
It's almost like
to keep HRC in the paddock. And I know some people who are, you know, it's like you do get quite a lot of fans who can't stand MotoGP and they're just into BSB and World Superbike. And they were saying, are they going to ruin it? But I think, like you say, it could benefit everybody if they just make it a little bit, not super stock, but more towards that. Because BSB last year, some of the racing was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's worrying, isn't it? I honestly feel that, you know, if you choose either MotoGP, World Superbike or British Superbike, consistently the best racing to watch has definitely been BSB, then World Superbike, then MotoGP. If you throw Moto2 and Moto3 into the mix, they've been really good racing, dead exciting to watch. World Supersport's been kind of all right, depth of field-wise, hasn't been brilliant, I don't think, these last couple of years, but certainly the front men are going. British Super Sport, fantastic. So, yeah, if I had to choose a class, if you came from outer space and went to a meeting for excitement, I would say British Championship would be more chance of getting some, you know, sort of bare knuckle racing, you know.
I remember as a kid, sort of early or late teens, going to Snetterton to a BSP round, or it wasn't called BSP then, but it was the British GP, I think. And it hearing an old fella saying, if you want to see the best racing, go to your local club race. If you want to see the best racers, then you go and watch GPs, you know. And it was, even then, it was that sort of differentiation.
I would, to some extent, agree with that. I mean, the thing with British Championships is the rule changes have actually worked in BSB. You know, it's worked really well. A lot more affordability for teams to be competitive that wouldn't necessarily be. You know, WFR Honda and GB Motors and, you know, Padgett's got a win and all that kind of thing, you know. And I don't think we would have done under the old rules.
No. Well, talking of BSB, there's been some strange stuff. I was wondering what your thoughts on Michael Laverty going off to join the to ride the CRT after Shakey turned it down.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand his thinking. The thinking is that at the end of 2013, CRT is then defunct, and the grids are going to be, they say, filled with leased Hondas and Yamaha motors in sort of prototype chassis. And I think his plan is, if he stayed in Britain, what's he going to do? Tread water again, you know, have a good chance of winning the championship, but, you know, wouldn't be a given that he'd win it. If he went to MotoGP, if he clicks for this CRT bike, all he's got to do is beat the other CRT bikes, and then maybe he's in a good position for 2014. I think that's what he's thinking, and, you know, who's to say that ain't a good plan?
Yeah. I mean, when Shakey was named by Paul Bird as his preferred option for next year, he did say in a statement, and I know Birdie has a tendency to make statements that are quite sort of dramatic, but he said, you know, if Shakey decides he wants to stay in BSB because he's only three wins away from Kianari's record, he said Tommy Hill was his next preferred. Now, Tommy's just announced he's taking a year's sabbatical, but he doesn't seem happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, the news here, not understandable thing that's happened in the paddock this last couple of months is Tommy's announcement that he ain't going to race this year. Like you said, the sabbatical, but why? I don't know, really. He couldn't really explain it to me, or didn't want to, I don't think. He's quite political, I get the impression, and he's not happy about a lot of things that's gone on. He doesn't think that, you know, a rider of his calibre to go and find $200,000 to you know, progress in the sport. And I think, you know, there's a lot of that. I think he might just end up getting bored of, you know, odd carrying for his dad and his brother on a building site. It's a strange one for me. That, I mean, you know, I never once thought of sitting out for any kind of protest. I don't know. I mean, he's having a kid sometime very soon, so maybe that's had a bearing on it. And, you know, it's his choice. It's not an easy sport to sort of succeed at, and it's dangerous at times. And, you know, he doesn't, you know, owe the sport anything if he wants to have a year out. But I still really don't know why, I must admit.
No, I mean, he had some absolutely rotten luck this year, mainly due to me picking him in mid Motorcycle News Fantasy League, I think. Well, I put him in my team, and then we had the Aston thing where he rode into a mechanic, or a mechanic stepped in and flipped his bike over on the warm-up lap. And it was like, oh, man, it was crazy. In really quite exciting news, Josh Brooks staying at Taiko Suzuki, they announced that he's going to run the TT next year.
Yeah, that's the other big news. And it's been a surprise to some people, but not for many, because he has made a real effort to get to the Isle of Man every time he can. He always does his parade laps. He goes really quick on them. And I'd heard, you know, about 3-4 months ago that he'd spent a lot of his time going from Ireland to the Isle of Man. He spent weekends and weekends and weekends over there when he hadn't been racing. Any time he can, he's been over there lapping round on anything he can get his hands on. So he's definitely taking it seriously. And he'll go quick. There's no question of that. He's no money, Josh. You know, the only thing that normally stops a rider of his calibre doing the Isle of Man is the fact they don't want to. Obviously, that's too dangerous, or they don't need to. When I spoke to him down at the NEC, I says, you don't need to do it. He says, no, I don't need to do anything, only breathe and eat, but I want to do it. What can you say? You
know, and he's going to be Guy Martin's teammate at the TT, I guess, because
Guy Martin's guy, yeah, I mean, I don't think, even he doesn't think, I think he'll do 125 mile an hour. I don't think he's going to finish top. He might finish top six, top seven in some of them. But I think give it a couple of years. If he still wants to do it after he's done a TT, which is not guaranteed by any means, he might do a lap. And I've seen it happen. I've seen good riders go over there and do a lap and then say, you know what, it ain't for me.
Yeah.
But I've got a feeling that he isn't going to be one of them. I think he'll be coming back. And I think that, fair play to him. You know, you've got to respect that kind of, it's his decision. He's decided to go. I think he'll be good at it. And fair play.
He's been a revelation this year. Well, not a revelation, because I think his talent was always there, but he really seems to have, he seems a lot more focused.
Yeah, I think he's had I think last year was quite unlucky in that he tried a lot of things, on the track, and they might have worked and they didn't. Every time that he tried something, any kind of move, pass, you know, it always backfired. And this year he's done the same thing and approached it the same way, but he's kind of had a little bit of luck running with him. So, I think he's just been a bit more fortunate this year than last year. And I think last year was very unfortunate because it always went wrong. He was just on the wrong, side of it every single time. So, I think about him going to Isleman, I think he knows what the job is. He knows you can't go over there and do 130 mile an hour first year. I don't think he's going to try. And I think that I think he'll be good.
And now his teammate in BSB is going to be PJ Jacobson, who really set the place alight when he came over and picked up a few wildcard rides in the super sport level.
Two riding super stock. He had one at Oulton and one at Donington. He finished seventh at Oulton. He won at Donington, and then he won first time out on the super sport bike at Assen, and he wanted to win. I mean, good little rider and a lot of art. I've got a feeling on a super bike, he's going to take his time a little bit learning the circuits, because he's only been to about half of them. Or he's going to push and he's going to do a bit of damage, I think. But, good luck to him.
Well, he was on the show last week. Jim was talking to him and he certainly sounds up for it. He sounds really enthused.
Oh, he's up for it. He's a good kid as well. Yeah. Nice little fella. Always got a good word. Very, very American in that he's sort of very PR savvy, and you just get the impression sometimes he's trying to think of the right thing to say instead of being a bit natural, but that's no bad thing. And he's an asset to the paddock and certainly a good rider. I just feel that if he pushes as hard on a superbike as what it was on a super sport bike, it's more likely to bite him on the ass than the super sport bike was.
Yeah. Yeah. We spoke earlier, we mentioned Shaky is obviously after this record.
Yeah.
Rumours that Keo might be coming back. Have you heard anything substantial?
Back, don't quote me on it, but I think it's definite from what I've heard. And he's back with Samsung Honda and it's done. That's what I've heard. But as I say, don't quote me on it. But I think
he seems so suited to BSB. And then I saw him at Donington in World Superbikes in that pretty dreadful year on the handspree, Ben Carter. The race he won in the wet, where he was just sideways all the time, and it was absolutely mind-blowing. And that was it. I mean, that was pretty much his best race of the year.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, Keo is, he's either out of cold or it doesn't seem to be much in between, or reason for him going off the boil. You know, everything's the same. It's difficult to see how somebody can be. There's that big a difference between when they're on form and when they're not on form. You know, it's massive. It's, it's gone from winning easily to unable to be in the top 15, which is a big swing there. You know, and who knows? I mean, I think I don't think it'll cost the team anything to have him. I mean, he's an Honda man. I think Honda will take care of him financially. Yeah. And who knows if he can recapture anything like his form that's taken him to as many championships as he's had, you'd never bet against him. But he said, you know, whether that can amp, you know.
And we got Split Last Aprilia with a fair bit of World Superbike experience there, Kuba Smirts and Mark Aitchison.
Yeah, they've also been sort of upgraded as a team, if you like. They're now the official Aprilia importer team with backing from the factory, so they ought to have, you know, more kind of, well, it's difficult under British Championship technical regs to, you know, they're not going to be able to just nick flipping some old engines off Bianchi's bike from last year. But they certainly should have technically more backup and a bike that's more competitive. And Smirts and Aitchison are good riders. The big question mark there is learning circuits. Big learning curve for a pair of them.
Yeah, yeah. Again, last week, Jim had Mark Miller on. He's just back from Macau where he ran the Split Lath Redmond Aprilia there. And Mark was saying that, you know, it's a fantastic bike. It handles really nicely. The only thing was, because they didn't have the World Superbike level electronics package, there was no wheelie control. And he said, and the darn thing just wants to wheelie out of every corner. And I was thinking, somewhere like Cadwell or Alton, that could be a bit of an issue, I guess.
Yeah, I think, and that's going to be an issue in the UK because BSB are obviously running controlled ECU, so you're limited as to what you actually, you know, can do. I know that the Philly guy was telling me down at NEC that in actual fact, the ECU they're going to have to run for BSB is a lot less sophisticated than the standard ECU on the road bike. So in as far as what it can do and what control you've got over certain aspects. But, you know, it is a good bike.
I mean, that seems bizarre where, I mean, the idea of super stock is it's basically, you know, a bike lifted out of a showroom,
isn't it?
Yeah. And yet if you have to dumb it down to meet the super bike rules from what you can have on the road, it just seems a bit crazy.
Yeah, it does a little bit, but I mean, I still think the rules in BSB have worked. I still think that, you know, it's a good thing that they went that way. But it does seem a little bit nuts when a lot of the road bikes now are coming out with a lot very sophisticated, you know, engine management, traction control, wheelie control, and then in BSB you can't run it.
No. And I've got to mention your long-time sparring partner on the when you do your grid walks, Bomber Harris is back. Carl Harris is going to ride for PR Kawasaki next year.
Yeah, he's got a full-time ride. He tends to not last a full season, does Carl, for various reasons. I love Carl, loads and loads of natural talent, never going to be slow on a bike. He's totally the opposite of Keo. He's always going to be able to jump on a bike and just rely on his tons of natural talent to get him around very quick, regardless of what the bike's doing or what he's feeling or what the team setup is. And who knows? I mean, he's quick. He's got to work on his fitness, and I still think he wants to do it, though, when you speak to him, you know, and he's quick. He's a quick rider, and he always will be. He's just, you know, he's just a naturally talented lad who is always going to be able to jump on a bike and pedal it around pretty quick. He ain't going to win a championship, though.
No. And finally, really, it's just, I was interested looking at the BSS grid, the British Supersport grid. You've got Stuart Easton, Alistair Seeley, Graeme Gowland going down there. Ben Wilson's still there. Glenn Richards is still there. Taylor McKenzie's still there. Kennedy, I'm guessing, is still there. Jack Kennedy.
I haven't actually heard about where Jack Kennedy's going. There were rumours of him going World Superspot, but I think he's going to be still in British BSS.
Yeah, that's a very strong grid, but I'm interested to see all these guys coming down from Superbikes. I'm not sure if that's a sign of a healthy situation or not.
Well, me neither. There's a few newcomers into BSB that should be a few down. I think you've got Smirts coming in, Aitchison, Keo coming back. But it's a good championship. That BSS championship's mega. I mean, that is the one that's going to be impossible to call. It really is.
Yeah.
Seeley, for me, is going to be a front runner. Easton, if he can get his mojo back. He suits them little bikes better than he ever did the super bike class. The new Triumph's going to be bigger than all, you know. That new 675 is going to be good.
Yeah, that's so, a new rebuild, isn't it?
Yeah, so that is going to be a proper competitive championship, it is.
Yeah, no, very much looking forward to that. James, fantastic as ever. As we get closer towards the season, no doubt we'll come back to you.
Yep.
And just to wrap up, how was Motorcycle Live? What were the crowds like? I didn't get up there myself this year. Just, we've got our new aircraft, so I've just sort of spending my time polishing it.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Motorcycle Live was good. I really enjoy it. We had plenty going on stage, me and Steve Parrish, loads of new games. And weekends are best because you get a lot more sort of top riders here. Carl Crutchlow, we had, you know, Scott Redding, we had all the superbike riders, Aslan Ray, tons of people, all the BSS lads, Shaky, Tommy Hill, even people we had on stage like Ed Clanter, the Olympic gold medalist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All sorts of people like that. We had a lot of famous people who are into bikes down there. And the show was good. I had a good pimp round, and my highlight of the show was a retro Kawasaki Z1000 that the Italian importers had actually built, and it just looked nice. And I thought, you know what, I'd have one of them. But there's plenty to look at. I mean, it's a good show.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's always a success, isn't it? Yeah. I remember hearing an interview with an American bike journalist who'd been across and been to his first one. He was like, wow. You know, it's like everyone in the country comes to it. But then, of course, we don't have the distances to travel, I suppose, they do in the States.
Not like they do there, no.
Fantastic. James, thanks ever so much for taking the time to speak to us again. Looking forward to next season. Inevitably going to be the best season ever, at least until it starts. Just hope the weather's a bit kinder. It's been
To be honest,
mad.
World Superbike had some shit weather, so did MotoGP. British Superbikes didn't do that bad, considering we've had the worst summer ever in Britain that I can remember for wetness. And we only had a couple of wet races, so we got away with a lot of it in Britain, to be honest. I mean, I remember being sat at Assen in pit lane, and it was beautiful, and we were watching the footage coming out of Portimao, and it was bloody awful. So, you know, we did really well for BSB, I think.
One last thing, and it just came up when we were talking earlier about Josh Brooks, and it's about the third time I've said finally or one last thing, but
yeah.
You've ridden the TT, you've raced the TT,
yep.
You've raced short circuit primarily.
Yes.
You get someone like Michael Rutter, who's, you know, has been a front runner in BSB. He's just won his eighth Macau.
Yeah.
You know, and yet you get John McGuinness, who is, you know, certainly at the moment, since Jerry Dunlop left us, you know, the undisputed king of the island. But when he goes on short circuit, he's not that competitive. What is it that makes someone good at one thing and not another, and then the odd person who can translate it? Because I completely agree with you. I think Josh Brooks might turn out to, if he gets the bug and that puts a massive grin on his face, I think he might keep going back then. He could be rather good at it.
Yeah, I think he can further his career by another 5 or 6 years. It's not as physical over there. It's mentally very demanding, and obviously there's a bit more danger element. But I think he can make a few quid over the next 5 or 6 years there and extend his career if he wants to do that. What you're asking is, why do some riders only good on the roads and not good on short circuits? The reason is because you're not on the limits of grip everywhere. That's the only thing pretty much that matters, is getting a set up and getting a feel for how much grip you've got. That's what it's about in short circuits. And that's difficult to do. The Isle of Man and the roads, you've got more things on your mind, but different things. You're not on the limits of grip as much, but you've got the dangers. You need to be accurate every single lap. You make a mistake, it's going to hurt you in a big way, and that's a pressure all of its own. One of the reasons that people like Rutter have done well at both is because they are the people who are good on short circuits who decide to do the roads. You know, there's no question that if you've got somebody like, you know, Tommy Hill or Shaky Byrne, and they've wholeheartedly wanted to go and do the TT and did the learning and, you know, got their head into it and went for 3 or 4 years, they'd be quick there. There's no question of that.
Right.
But, you know, that's not to say it's easy to be a John McGuinness. You know, it's a difficult thing to sit on that road before you fly off down Bray Hill. I could sit on a world championship grid, and I was never, ever scared of falling off. Did not frighten me. Not doing as well as I thought or the team thought I could do frightened me. I was scared of failure, not of falling off. The Isle of Man, when you're queuing up to go, you've got that. You don't want to fail. You don't want to be slow. But you know if you make one tiny mistake, it can end up really quite badly for you. And that's a different kind of pressure, and you've got to cope with that. And, you know, a lot of the short circuit riders couldn't. And, you know, that's a fact. So is it any easier to be John McGuinness than it is to be, you know, Josh Brooks? No, he's hard in a lot of ways.
So it's more an inclination kind of thing. You need the inclination and the talent, whereas on short circuits, you kind of just need the talent.
The consequences are not as severe on the short circuit, so you can push that limit. You know, to do what John does on the road, you know, for a lot of people, that would be over their limit and it wouldn't end too good for them. So, you know, it's a different thing. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I am saying that if you've got a top short circuit rider and, you know, they had the mindset that they really wanted to do the Isle of Man and they put the effort in, they'd be quick. Question of that.
Yeah. So it'll be trying to get the cameras to catch Josh Brooks's face as he finishes his first practice. And if he's got a massive grin, think, hey, oh, yeah, this could be interesting.
I hope to be there for it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've got to gonna have to get across there at some stage, but
yeah, well, can't you just say you got lost and your sat nav went down and just you ended up in Isle of Man?
I could have got away with that with the Bolco, but with the new aircraft, it's got that many different kinds of nav aids in it. Oh, it's fantastic. You have to, I'd say when we get some nice weather, you'll have to bring the RV6 up here again, and I'll show you the new baby. Oh, it's fabulous. Excellent. James, seriously, this is about the third time I've wrapped up, I think. Thanks ever so much indeed. I won't keep you any longer, and we will speak to you again very soon.
Lovely. Cheers, mate.
Brilliant.
Thanks,
cheers, man. James. Cheers. Shut up.
So, yet again, fantastic chat with James, and no doubt we will be back with James before the season kicks off in the end of February for the World Superbikes. Bit of news. They're still at it.
I know. This is getting silly.
Him and Rossi are still having snipes at each other. Rossi, in an interview, said was basically saying that he believed Casey had never got over losing it to him at Laguna in 2008. He said he just wasn't man enough to accept that he just lost. And Casey Stoner retweeted, "I think Valentino feels a little bit more brave now I'm not there."
Okay. This may never stop for a while. I know that I saw a photo the other day that Casey was testing in a V8 car. So just as a side note.
Yeah.
He's
speaking of four wheels, didn't Rossi just win the Monza rally?
Hello, no, thank you very
he
much.
Did win it.
Yeah, he did win it. That'd be awesome if they start, you know, going at each other about four wheels.
That'd be so funny.
That's right. They had a Supermoto where the Marco Simoncelli day they held.
Yeah.
And Dovizioso won the Supermoto race.
That's right.
Which must have pissed off all the professional Supermoto riders they had there.
And there was a great photo of Rossi leading Biaggi.
Oh, yeah. Oh, bless.
I heard something about them making up there.
Yeah. And now they both follow each other on Twitter. I mean, it's like, you know, happy times.
Well, it's sort of what happens on the pitch doesn't have to. No, okay. Maybe not with those two. David Emmett tweeted a link to a Spanish article in Solo Moto, which I ran through Google Translate. It's an interview with Masao Furuzawa. And interestingly, he's very open. He talks quite openly about his thoughts on Ducati, on Yamaha. And one of the things he said is that the Yamaha racing department didn't really want Rossi, but the marketing department did. And the marketing, any race team's marketing department is going to want Valentino Rossi on board. And that sort of goes without saying. But interesting, the marketing department won that one. So they've got him back.
Well, they bring money in, whereas the racing department spends it.
Yeah,
You know.
Well, on top of that, you're also talking about a Google Translate translation of a Spanish article.
You know, yes. Quoting a Japanese guy talking English, probably.
Yes.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I tried to make it out, I think, from the last bit of the interview, Furuzawa's being employed as a consultant for Yamaha's expedition to Mars next year or something. Very difficult to make it out.
I actually believe that the way he said it was that they didn't need him, and they certainly he was an expensive guy to bring on board, and that the marketing guys pushed it through.
Right.
So let's see what else we got here. We have this MotoGP.com is doing a really nice little series of shows. They this week it's about Casey Stoner, and they do a special week after week. They did the Cortese one. Yeah. And Marquez, well, now they're doing Casey Stoner this week, so that's worth catching. It's kind of in a format of like highlights, and it's not after the flag because it's not Gavin Emmett.
Yeah, Gavin's like basically traveling all over the world and teasing everybody with where he's going. I'll be honest, and this is constructive criticism. The show's a little slow. Now, we could obviously be accused of the exact same thing.
A bit.
But I was having some trouble. You know, it's nice having Ozzy in there and all that, but I was having some trouble keeping my interest. So it's great to have you guys, and I love it, and keep it up. I'm just like, come on, let's go. Let's get some of that, you know, Emmett energy going. So Gavin, come back from wherever you are. Yeah. And juice this thing up.
Cool.
And Jules, you've been looking at looking for Casey Stoner merchandise.
Well, yeah. So, hey, Tony Pags out there. He and I had a bet at the beginning of the season, which I won, and he owes me a Casey Stoner T-shirt, and we are having a really tough time finding official Casey Stoner gear. We found like the championship shirt. It's available in dealers in Australia.
I suspect we're going to get about 10,000 emails from Aussies now.
Good.
telling us either how to get it or asking for our address to send them to us.
Which would be good.
That's what
I was going to ask. But you know, it what just amazes me is we've got a two-time world champion.
Yeah.
In the top 10 of all-time winners, and he's going to be there for a while, pretty much I'm betting until Marquez catches up with that group of, because the other guys that have as many wins as him are guys who are already who are racing right now already are in there, you know, like
right.
Lorenzo and Pedrosa and Rossi. So he's going to be up at this top 10, and he was recently given that 20th GP legend status.
Yep.
And you can't get a freaking shirt. And it really fits, actually, Casey Stoner, because I could just see him. And I actually exchanged some emails with David Emmett about this. And it really fits the character, actually. You know, I mean, he's not into merchandising. I mean, he's the last guy who would probably be like, yeah, that'd be awesome. Let's get some shirts.
You know? He's not that bothered, isn't he?
No.
If he was bothered about money, he'd have stayed.
I suspect if he was going to do T-shirts and a T-shirt cannon, his would be slightly more powerful than Collins and aimed at some different people.
Not fans.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, if you are in Australia and if you have knowledge of or access to, you know, something semi-official, there's plenty of stuff that you can get, you know, on eBay and shit like that. But I'm looking for an official kind of Repsol Casey Stoner shirt, either whether it's 27 or number one.
One of the Australians was tweeting saying that there is, I presume from his parents' farm, you can get Casey Stoner fruit, but obviously it wouldn't survive the postage. But he said they bought a bag of grapes and they were really sour. I'm here.
Martin.
And there's a good reason. This is the end of the year show, folks.
Yeah. Now, one thing that we have talked about recently and we've been chasing up is the development of this brand new, it's still virgin land, Circuit of Wales, which is being developed. And we've managed to make contact with Chris Herring, who's a name some of you may know. He's been around in and around racing for many years, former press manager for or communications manager for HRC, for the Castle Honda World Superbike team. He's the manager of Leon Haslam currently. And Chris was approached several years ago. This goes back a lot further than anyone was aware, to start a new race series with the idea of bringing up, you know, new talent, primarily British, but could be based here, but obviously, you know, looking abroad as well, if necessary. And he was a bit, oh, you know, I've been doing this for a lot of time. We're going to hit the same old problems. And then quickly it became apparent that what they wanted to do, which would incorporate race teams being based at a circuit, you know, there just weren't the facilities available, affordable in the country. So they decided to build a circuit from the bottom up. But it's not just the race circuit. The race circuit attracts the industry, but the industry supports the race circuit. So there's going to, they've had all sorts of consultations with Leon and Ron Haslam have been involved. They've got Dougie Lampkin and Roger Harvey, our advisors. There's going to be an indoor dirt track, so that'll be running 365 days a year. They'll do everything from a Colin Edwards type boot camp for novices like Simon Pavey does, to, you know, race academies. There'll be workshops. They've already bought FTR, and FTR are going to be moving there from Buckinghamshire to continue their chassis building. But the best thing, I think, I was talking to him last night, and he said the inspiration was John Lukey, which the surname, I thought, oh, yeah, he wouldn't be Australian by any chance. But I didn't know this story. In 1929, John Lukey stood on what is now Lukey Heights at Phillip Island, looking across the land he owned, and with a pen and paper just sketched what the circuit would look like. And it pretty much still does.
Oh, wow.
So Chris sat down in the Haslam's kitchen with Ron and Leon and said, look, we've got this project. This is seriously exciting. But we're going to design a race circuit. How would you guys do it? What would you do? They just said, and they pretty much all came up with the same answer. We take the best corners from the best circuits in the world and stick them together and see if we can make it work. And that's what they're pretty much doing.
How old was Neon when that was done? Because that circuit's been there for a while.
Which circuit are we talking about?
Phillip Island.
No. Sorry, this is for the circuit.
The Wales.
Sorry. Yeah. Carry on.
No, that was 1929. That was John Lukey. But so that was the inspiration for, you know, starting with a blank sheet of paper rather than doing it by computer. Now, obviously, computers, I'm sure, will be involved to work out the geometry of it, but not to design as many corners, you know, a Valencia, what do you guys call them, a cookie cutter circuit. So this is where it's come from. Dorna and FIM have been on board from the start, and the start was well over 2 years ago, and it is progressing fast. The land is their own. They've got 830 acres site. That's only 23 less than Silverstone. And Silverstone, trust me, having walked across
it's a big one. Yeah, I know.
It's massive.
I've seen it on Google Maps.
A lot of height variation. It's got great road access with the M4 corridor coming up from London. You know, I mean, it is going to be something really interesting. And the best bit is, you'll be able to hear all of this from Chris, because once we get into the new year, we're going to get Chris on board. Once they start the construction, I'm going to try and get myself down there and actually do some face-to-face stuff. That's something that will follow over the next two or so years. They're looking at 2015 to be ready to start hosting. And they're going for two wheels. He said the biggest events in Britain, other than Formula One, which they're not particularly... It would meet Formula One spec, but that's not their target. Who chooses to work with Bernie Eccleston? that's not their target. But the next three biggest events in the UK are MotoGP, World Superbike, and British Superbike. So that's what they're going for. And
we look forward to it as progress is being. Look forward to hearing what Chris has to say. That'll be cool.
Absolutely.
Yep. Let's get another another bit of an interview in here. I think this would be a good time to toss in perhaps Simon and Steve, and then maybe we'll save Josh for the end. Sound good?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, so we'll roll both Simon Pavey, a ninth Dakar coming up, as well as Steve Brooks' Temples of Speed number one. I just want to make sure we keep that in.
Yeah, it's roll about it, Salzburgring, which is a track that you kind of have to go back in the archives to see any real racing there. Recently, there hasn't been any World Series there. But it's a track that reminds me a lot of Assen, actually. It's the same kind of too long, kind of windy, but very fast windy straights, and even a tight little chicane at one point. So anyway, let's let Steve do that run through.
All right, zoom.